Hey, thanks for checking out this episode of the Lake Effect Podcast. My name is James Proffitt, and today I'm visiting with Alberto Rey, an exceptional artist, noted Orvis fly fishing guide, and a profound conservationist. Hey, Alberto. Thanks for meeting with me today.
It's my pleasure.
First of all, where are we at?
We are in the basement of my studio, which is on the banks of Kennaway Creek in Fredonia, New York, waiting to get some water so we can get some steelhead moving up. We haven't had much of anything yet, but hopefully that'll change.
Okay, great. Downstream, a couple miles is Lake Erie, is that correct?
That's correct.
For people that may not know, what is an Orvis guide?
An Orvis guide is an angler who's been vetted by Orvis, and they take their guide program pretty seriously. And we have to go through quite a few regulations and a few things that they would like us to do. I think one of the main things that's different is that after every guide trip, we have our clients do surveys, and that dictates whether we remain endorsed or not.
Do you work as a guide mostly on Lake Erie tributaries?
Entirely on Lake Erie tributaries, yeah. That's kind of my home waters. There's about 7 or 8 streams within 40 minutes of here.
Okay. What's your quarry?
Mostly steelhead. We do steelhead from October through April, and then there's a slow period for a few weeks, and then we do smallmouth bass in early June.
Fly fishing for smallmouth bass. That's not something you hear a lot about.
Oh, it's a lot of fun. The fish are fairly aggressive. They're all lake run, so they're pretty fat and aggressive. They just hit your fly with abandon.
You're a professor? You still are a professor?
I retired 2 years ago. Okay. I was a drawing and painting professor at State University of New York in Fredonia. 2 years ago, I decided to retire after 33 years and concentrate on my art and guiding and writing on the side.
Art. I know you do some pottery work, mostly painting. Is that correct?
Correct. Mostly painting. I do mostly environmental work dealing with rivers and bodies of water and issues that are related to those bodies of water. The pottery kind of is a offshoot of that. I mostly work in oils, and I do watercolors when I'm traveling, and using the watercolors to supplement the content to my writing that I'm doing when I travel.
A lot of your projects are prefaced with the words biological regionalism. How would you explain that to someone?
Yeah, I think the idea of biological regionalism is that the artwork tries to examine bodies of water that are near the exhibition site, so that the people who go see the work are familiar with either the bodies of water or the area that the paintings are about. And the idea is, if you can understand the issues that are local, that are regional, then you have a better idea of understanding more global issues. And it's all interconnected, but it's important to understand, you know, what's in your backyard first. And by understanding that, you're more sympathetic to what might be happening around the world.
So are you saying that someone that's already at least partially aware of these bodies of waters or these streams is more likely to get more from your artwork than something that might be on the other side of the world they've never seen?
Correct. I think if they drive by these streams or played in the streams when they were kids or fish on the streams, they're going to be more connected to this artwork. And then usually I try to put some artwork that is from around the world, because a lot of the issues that we face locally, and it doesn't really matter where it is, they're universal issues. That anywhere that there's any civilized settlements along a river or a body of water is going to have environmental issues that can be relatable to any other stream in Nepal or Italy or Iceland. If those bodies of water aren't protected, then the chances are they're probably going to be degraded or polluted.
One of your projects was the Oswego River. Another one involves Gajakwita Creek. What can you tell me about those two tributaries?
Correct. One is the Gajakwita flows into Lake Erie, and it's an interesting stream because several decades ago, probably over 60 decades ago, the river flowed through the middle of Buffalo, through the outskirts of Buffalo. Now it's in the middle because the city grew, but it was so polluted that the residents, instead of thinking about cleaning it up, they decided to bury it. So they actually built a tunnel, and they put the river in underneath in the tunnel as a way to just more or less forget about it, so that they didn't have to smell or see the debris that was in the river. And that river to this day kind of goes around a lot of communities, but it still gets millions of gallons of sewage every year. So it's still something that is a problem, and it's still yet to be resolved. The Oswego River, similar issues. It starts in a very kind of pristine area, part of the canal system in New York. And as it gets closer to the town of Oswego and other towns, a lot of industry during the 50s and 60s and even 40s used the river as a way of disposing their chemicals. So there's a lot of chemicals still in the water,
right,
and a lot of pollution that's still evident. Although, there's a lot of regulation, but some of those chemicals are very difficult to remove.
Are things on these bodies of water improving, in your opinion?
They've improved, but it's kind of hit a plateau, a lot of it. I think the Oswego River was a body of concern by the EPA, and it's still pretty polluted.
Is it safe to say Gajakwita Creek will never be resurfaced again in the section that's below ground now?
That's pretty safe. I think there's highways and buildings and campuses that are built on top. I don't think that's ever going to be.
That's very unfortunate.
Yeah.
So you paint canvases and works of all size, small and large, but your exhibits and your work also encompass extensive writings, videos, photographs, and other materials. If someone goes to an exhibition to see your work, is it going to be different than going to a typical museum or a typical art gallery where the work is there and it's that's it?
Yeah, I think for me, it's important that the work is accessible to a diverse audience. So if you're an angler, you'll go and you'll see the exhibition, and you might find these paintings about rivers and fish to be kind of interesting. If you're a scientist, you'll read the captions and you'll understand a lot about the scientific data that that I've incorporated into the quality of the water. If you don't know anything about science or art, I think you'll find a lot of things that are in the installation that is accessible to those who, you know, usually don't go to museums or galleries. And if you are an artist, I think you'll see the quality of the installation and the paintings and videos to be hopefully of a caliber that is intriguing and interesting. So each exhibition, each puzzle has there's a lot of research that goes into it. And consequently, I think if I were just to do a painting, a lot of information would be lost. So what I generally try to do is try to make that kind of complicated information accessible to the public through panels or videos. And I also do websites for each project. So when an exhibition is over, you'll have this permanent record through a website that the viewer can go years later and find this work, these paintings or videos, and the information that I put together to supplement the artwork that was in the exhibition.
With the additional features that come with your artwork exhibitions, does this make your work more actionable than paintings only or drawings only by the consumer?
That is the hope. My hope is that I'm not trying to preach to the audience. I don't think that's probably the best way to lose an audience. My approach is to present the information and then let the viewer decide what they want to do, if anything, and just hopefully understand a little bit more about their environment and be a little bit more sympathetic to what's happening, so that if there are decisions to be made in the future with policies and politicians, that they will have a better background from which to make decisions on how to move forward with those politicians or policies.
In the time that you've been a guide, that you've been fishing waters in this area, do you see a single most significant threat to Lake Erie or its tributaries, or is it an entire suite of threats?
As I started this podcast, I mentioned that we're still waiting for water. I mean, it's when I started guiding over 20 years ago, we would be in the beginning heavily into steelhead season. And what used to be, you know, October used to be, you know, a lot of fish, a lot of water. Now, you know, we barely have any water, a small trickling of fish coming in. And so it has changed quite a bit. Again, back then, I'd say the peak of the season used to be mid-November, and now it's mid-December. And what I mean by peak is that every stream that would have steelhead. And now that's, you know, it's not happening until mid-December. So that keeps changing, and everything is connected. So, you know, you change one thing and it kind of vibrates through everything else, ripples through other things. So I think that's continuing to be an issue. I think the other thing that I find is that the environment is very sensitive, and consequently, I think it's important that as anglers and sportsmen and women, that we are stewards of that environment, so that, you know, if the water's too hot, that we don't fish because it could endanger the fish that are cold-blooded. And we just be, you know, more ethical in how we fish and how we, you know, interact with other anglers, and, you know, become more active in organizations that protect the environment. And if you don't have time to do that, then, you know, support those organizations with funds if that's a possibility.
Speaking of stewardship, you are involved in some programs locally with streams and with youth especially. What can you tell me about some of the things that you participate in or operate or ever see?
When I first moved to the area 33 years ago, actually 35 years ago, I knew nothing about it. I'd heard about salmon running into streams and steelhead, and I didn't fly fish back then. And I was like, you know, wow, that's crazy that's happening. And then as I started to read more and more about it, I thought that, you know, fly fishing is such a great sport to engage and understand the environment and use that in your fishing. And then I was living in Dunkirk, which has a high minority population. And again, I'm a minority. And I thought this would be a great sport to get youth out of the city and just engage with nature. And so 30 years ago, I started a youth fly fishing program, and it still continues to this day. We meet once a week. We tie flies for an hour and a half on Tuesdays. And then periodically, we take children out on the stream. We have waders, boots, rods, reels, everything that they need.
And how much do you charge the kids for that?
It's all free.
Okay.
And the reason is that when I was, I didn't want any child to be embarrassed by their economic status. And I wanted every child to feel like they could walk in off the street and participate in fly fishing and never worry about how much it would cost. And that continues to this day.
Are you creating future stewards and conservationists with this program?
That's the plan. We also stock brook trout in the stream in Canadaway. They're indigenous. They were native to the river. And so we actually buy two-year-olds, and we are always looking for sponsors. One of our major sponsors passed away for that program. And what we do is we put in two-year-old brooders, which are brook trout that are ready to spawn. And so as soon as they go into the stream, we usually put them in late October, so that the water is around the same temperature as the hatchery. And then they'll be in cold water for months and they can spawn. And we've had anecdotal evidence from landowners that they've seen brook trout spawning in their tributaries.
Is it a self-sustaining population at this point, or you can't?
I can't tell.
Okay.
We don't know how to do that. I mean, we know how to do that. We just don't have the funds to, you know, tag fish,
right,
and that type of thing. But we have done electrical shocking in August, which is the warmest, most, you know, critical period. And we have found the brook trout that we put in were still surviving in the stream. So there seems to be holdover from year to year.
Okay. Excellent.
Which is good. So we're trying to, and we also had stream cleanup. And the idea is providing all these activities for the community and the children to participate in so that they have a sense of ownership in this environment, this land, this stream. And whether they stay in the area or not, that's something that they can carry with them wherever they go.
So you're teaching the kids about stewardship and conservation, but you're not necessarily preaching to them.
No, you never preach. You know, you just do what you do and let people make decisions on their own. That's the best way to do it.
Most of your artwork historically deals with water, whether it's from the Bagmati River in Nepal to local streams in this region on Lake Erie. What is it about water and humans? What's the connection that seems to be universal?
As a guide for me, I study water so much. And when guide season starts, you know, I kind of feel like I have a pulse on all these streams and looking at water and rainfall and, you know, weather conditions, temperatures, you know, and then you're on a stream, you look at hydraulics and you look at how the fish, where they migrate and where they, you know, tend to collect and how they move. And, you know, it's just becomes part of who I've become. And so I've just become sensitized to the importance of water, again, locally and regionally, and how it affects me. But when I look at these bodies of water around the world, I realize that it's very similar. You know, I just came back from a 4.5 month trip around the world where I fished 26 different bodies of water. And it was interesting to me that a lot of the same flies we use here, mayflies and caddis, you can use anywhere around the world. There are some other bugs that are more distinctive that, you know, like the huge black beetles that are found in Patagonia. I mean, we don't get those here, but some of the staple of what we have in the United States can be used pretty much around the world. So that tells you how, you know, kind of connected and how similar our bodies of water and a lot of the entomology that's related to it is similar across the world, and that you kind of feel more connected because of that. So I think it's important to, again, try to understand the importance of protecting these bodies of water, because there are a lot of them are freshwater, and you know we a lot of communities depend on that fresh water.
For recreation.
Correct. Yeah. It's unfortunately a lot of the poor communities around the world are the communities that suffer most from trying to find clean drinking water.
Is there anything else interesting or noteworthy that I have not asked you about, either of these topics that people might want to know?
It doesn't take much to make a difference in your community. And what I mean by that is, again, that program, that youth fly fishing program that I've been doing for 30 some years, is just started by me wanting to do something in the community, but it only takes an hour and a half to 2 hours a week, and I enjoy it. So if there's people out there who have a skill that they think would be a benefit to their community, just do it in any way that you can, and do it in a way that you will enjoy doing it. Because if you try to do something for the long run, you're generally not going to do it if you don't enjoy it.
Like fishing and painting.
Exactly.
Hey, Alberto, I really appreciate you taking your time out to talk to me today, and hopefully I will see you somewhere around the lake.
Thank you. Yes, I'd love that.
For more information about Alberto Ray, his life and work, including links to various projects, visit www.albertoray.com. Thanks for joining me for this edition of the Lake Effect Podcast. I'm your host and producer, James Proffitt. Our executive producer is Chris Pfeiffer. To hear more, go to wgte.org/lakeeffect. And I hope to see you somewhere around the lake. WGTE. Voices around us.